Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the culture we love that society sometimes makes us feel ashamed of. My name is Caroline O'Donoghue and I bring my cat in a handbag into nightclubs. Joining me, who knows the precise location of those Yale plates, it's Diana Reid.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for bringing this amazing topic to the podcast. I couldn't be more excited, more trepidatious, or have more on the table with this.
Oh, good. Yeah, I also am so invested. Yeah. I am obsessed with Caroline Calloway, which is exactly how she wants it.
It's exactly how she wants it, precisely. So of all the things that you could have brought to Sentimental Garbage, why Caroline Calloway?
That's a good question. I think she is so... I think she is always changing, mm-hmm. and that makes her so watchable because I think she's a genuinely unpredictable public figure. And I also think that she is someone who is very conscious of how women are coded in the public eye. And I think she's very playful with that. And she's always subverting our expectations about what kind of public figure she is. And I think that is a very sentimental garbage vibe.
Like totally.
How people define themselves in relation to broader cultural narratives.
Totally. That's interesting you say that because I read some review, like Caroline Calloway. I'm also self-obsessed. It's a real Caroline trait.
Yeah.
I read a review somebody wrote about the podcast and someone said that it's a podcast about the stories women tell themselves. And I think Caroline Calloway is a story we tell ourselves in a way.
Yeah, and I think she's aware of that too. Like, I think she is consciously performing different tropes and changing them up and always trying to make us aware of the ways that we make assumptions about women and how we, the narratives that we use to understand them.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny because when I was making the notes for this episode, and it's, there's an extensive timeline that we will go through. So anybody who is not totally sure about this story or who this person is, we will really get into it. But it felt to me that as I was going through it, all this story that is made up of essentially non-events.
Totally.
Non-events like, kind of like friendship betrayals and also like non-events that are little like throw rugs that are thrown over huge events. Like, for example, this is a person whose like father died in a horrific way. And she sort of like tucks that very neatly under this like cheap Indian throw that is her friendship breakup with somebody we've never met and we'll never hear of outside of this context.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even that whole thing of like female frenemies, it sort of was having such a cultural moment at the time when it first came to light. And I feel like now we've moved on and Caroline Calloway is right there with us. And she too is like reanalyzing how we interpret that dynamic. And yeah, I feel like she's kind of in control of these narratives that we are trying to put onto her.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's like we think that we're the ones dissecting her, but she's always one step ahead of us.
Totally. And I remember the first sort of paradigm shift within the Calloway verse.
Literally, that's exactly it. Like, it's like she's scripting the whole thing and we're watching it in real time thinking that it's reality TV, but it's scripted,
Yeah, exactly. But she is the producer, the director, the writer,
exactly.
And everything.
Yeah.
And we'll get into all the sort of many paradigm shifts as we go through the chronology. But it strikes me, when the Kardashians started getting really, really famous?
Yes.
And their defenders, of which there are many, and many of them have like, pitched themselves for this show. But for me, it's like, I feel like there's too much Kardashians out there for me to even begin to dissect that meal. And also, I find them boring. Like,
right.
I find it interesting that like, we used to have this framework for fame and notoriety that was, if you are a really good singer or a really good actor or really good at being really good looking,
yeah,
or these like this set sort of thing of like, then we will allow you to be famous whether you want to or not. It doesn't matter if you like were in some crazy drama school and you live for your craft and you don't care about fame. We'll make you famous if you're good looking enough, and we will comb through your garbage. And in the last sort of 15 to 20 years through social media, this new kind of fame has emerged where people have sort of said, we will be the human shield that lies between the public and Meryl Streep.
Yeah, it's so true. Well, it's that famous for being famous thing.
Famous for being famous, which yeah. I don't think is a negative thing, because if someone's good at it, let them do it.
Let them do it. Yeah. And like, I think, I think that's what I love about Caroline Calloway, is that I think she's really expanding the way that we think about memoirists, because obviously, I mean, we'll get into it in the chronology. She does have conventional memoirs that she's published, but I think she said somewhere that Instagram has made us all memoirists.
Mm.
And so it's like, I love that idea that her, the sort of divide between the artist and the cultural products they produce has just totally evaporated, and she is the cultural product. And by living her life, she is like, just by existing, she's creating art, and by documenting her own existence, whether it be in like an Instagram story or a more conventional book, it's all part of the act. Do you know what I mean? Like there's sort of like, there's no fault line between like the author and the text. It's just all the same.
Right?
Like, she is the art.
And like, you could sort of say that about anybody who's like selling a book and also on Instagram. But with her, it's like she is creating these dramas, and you know, she's fanning the flames of these dramas all the time, and she's making these activities just interesting enough for them to be just sort of snackable and delicious.
Like, you don't feel guilty for you don't feel guilty for sort of bitching about the fact that her like online creative writing workshop didn't come off.
Yeah.
Because it's like, that's so low stakes. Whereas if it was like a genuine tragedy, you wouldn't, it wouldn't be delicious, as you say.
Exactly. And it's like all these like little beads of nothing, like creative workshops that don't work out, like paying your friend to write your Instagram captions, that these tiny little beads that you just put on the string, and none of them by themselves are anything, but then you're like, oh, what a lovely necklace.
Yeah. I don't agree though that you could say that of anyone who is like an artist and has social media. I think that a lot of people consciously resist it. Like, I feel like I mean, I don't have like a big public following at all, but as an author who also has social media, I very consciously resist it. Like, I'm always like, the book is the product and this is the news about the book. Mm-hmm. And you don't know anything about me from having read the book necessarily.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like Caroline is kind of showing us another way, which is, and I think for me, the instinct to separate the two is this idea that if I separate them, I'll somehow lose control, and that like the narrative of like who I am will be written by the public, which is obviously such a paranoid thing when I don't really have a public, but
you have a public.
I'm not trying to draw an equivalence, but I feel like with Caroline, she shows that Caroline can be the art and still be totally in control. Like, I think that she, the way that people talk about her and the way that people perceive her is exactly how she wants it to be. And I basically think she's scamming us all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that there is like a real Caroline Calloway who is like kept tucked away somewhere.
Yeah.
And she is not showing it deliberately.
I don't think she knows who that is though.
Oh, you don't think she knows?
No, I don't.
Okay,
and this is why I think that she is, and she makes me think so much about, she has this quote that I think about near constantly, which is in the most recent Vanity Fair long read, where the journalist is sort of questioning her about not paying her rent in New York.
Sorry, when you started that sentence, I was like, I really hope it's the same quote, because me and my friends say this to each other every day. Should we say it together?
Yes.
One.
So I'm going to get the writing wrong, but okay, it's like, it girls are startups and startups need funding.
Yes. Amazing.
It's incredible.
I just knew that was, I was like, it has to be that quote.
It's been going round and round in my head ever since it came out. And I think, and that quote has made me think about It Girls in general through the ages, like starting from like Clara Bow going up to like the Andy Warhol sort of phase of Edie Sedgwick, and then even more recently with like Alexa Chung and Sienna Miller, of like the thing about them is that they have this intangible quality that is not necessarily connected to talent, even though they may have some. Mm. It's not why people love them. It's like they are when they, it's like those people who are like incredibly photogenic, but for their entire personality. It's like when they step in front of a camera or speak into yes. a microphone, this something of this kind of barrel of charisma comes shooting out. And I think they don't understand it either.
Oh, I see. So that's why you think she doesn't really know who she is.
I think she right. knows it exists, but she, I think, I don't know. I don't think she knows who she is when she's alone.
Really?
Yeah.
So do you think, yeah, because I suppose this is why I find her trajectory fascinating, because I wonder if when you decide to sell, when you decide that the product is you and mm-hmm. that the business is your personality and your X factor and whatever that magic quality is, mm. do you think you create like, do you think that's like this Faustian pact that you make that means that you lose your sense of self? Or do you think the kinds of people who look for that dynamic are ones who don't know who they are outside the spotlight to begin with?
That's such an interesting question. And I think there for sure are people, I call this the sort of, I think I've spoken about the podcast before, it's called like the laser pointer theory.
Okay.
Where the people who are like the most successful, particularly women uh-huh. in the public eye, because I think, you know, men can just be like, I'm Chris Pine and I'm on the cover of Men's Health with my wrinkles in black and white and mm. I'm a real guy. That exists separately for men. But I also think they are limited by how straightforward they sort of have to be mm. kind of thing. I mean, straight men in the public eye. I think for very famous women, they need to have this version of themselves that exists without them. That like, if you think about like Dolly Parton mm. or Mariah Carey or just kind of outsized figures who are and Cher, like people who have been able to exist for a really long time, they have this like version of themselves that's like that a child could draw, that says sassy things and comes out every few years with an album and like says all the right things and hits their mark or whatever. And that is like, it's like a laser pointer they're shining through a fog over their shoulder while they have their real life, while they hang yes. out with their grandkids, while they talk to their gardener, while they like you watch TV, you yeah. know. And that, and I think that's a separate person, and those that divide happens over like decades generally of like someone being very famous for a very long time. I think when you start pursuing fame for one's own sake, just fame for like, I want to be this memoirist, I want to be this Cambridge girl, and now I want to be this sort of like slutty party girl, and now yeah. I want to be this girl. I think it does come from a sense of like, who am I when I'm alone?
Yeah.
Which okay. I find compelling and beautiful. It's very Edie Sedgwick, you know?
Well, it's also so human, right? Like,
yeah.
I think everybody finds it really hard to separate their like intrinsic self-worth from external validation. And that's, yeah. I guess, these are people just performing that kind of psychodrama on a global scale.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. That's
yeah.
So, yeah. I do think as well, I thought it was so, to your point about people who kind of like cultivate such a brand that they can kind of just like wheel the brand out. And it's
yeah. While the real them is still at home in a sense.
Yeah.
You know?
I thought it was so interesting that she, so she did this like big Vanity Fair profile where yeah. the It Girls Are Startups thing comes from. And she'd obviously, it was, the photo shoot was done in her home.
Mm.
And so I don't know if a photographer like helped stage it, but I assume she was influential in the staging.
Mm.
And one of the books she had on her desk obviously like blew up the pictures really big and like zoomed in as she intended. And one of the books on her desk was The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was such an interesting choice, because I think,
and you know, it was a choice as well.
Well, I'm assuming it was like,
yeah, well,
everything
is a planned to deliberate choice.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a whole stack and everything else was a memoir except for Eleanor Franti, who is anonymous, which is a very different vibe. She's mm-hmm. like a famously anonymous novelist. And then the other one was Donna Tartt, who I think is such a good example of that laser theory. Like yeah. she has been in the public eye for 30 years and she has basically worn the same outfit that entire time,
mm-hmm.
which is like crazy for a novelist
yeah.
who doesn't need to have a brand really.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, in Donna Tartt's decision to not have a brand, it is a brand because she's so private. She has
this
beautiful slick black bob, that sort of very tailored suit, that beautiful like Holly Hunter Southern accent.
Yes. Her accent is mad. Like, sorry, I know people speak like that, but like, it sounds like a character. Like,
yeah,
I think
her reading the secret history on audio is just
yeah,
a treat of
like,
all treats.
She doesn't look like a real person, and I think yeah, that's just how she wants it. And mm-hmm, I think that that creates, it generates its own intrigue because it's like they've created this walking fiction,
yeah,
and then you're always scrabbling to be like, but who's the real Donna Tartt?
Right.
And I think Caroline perhaps has some of that quality. She's obviously so much more of an oversharer, but I think because she's so obvious about the fact that she's always performing, it makes you like, it's like why fiction's interesting in the first place always, because
yeah,
you're like, how much is real and how much is performed? And
yeah,
like, I think if you felt like you were getting the real Caroline at any given point, it wouldn't be that interesting because you'd just be like, oh, okay, well, that's a woman who wants attention.
It's so funny. Before we started recording this podcast, you said, isn't it going to be weird because your name is also Caroline?
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, it won't be weird. And now you're saying Caroline is just someone who wants attention. I'm like, oh, God, dude, this is weird.
That's why she only does podcasts about people also called Caroline.
I mean, it's like, it's a very villainous name, you know? It's a, there's well, very yeah, few wholesome Carolines around.
That's true. And with the, yeah, with the alliteration of Calloway as well, which yeah, is a name she chose for herself.
Yeah. Yes. I think it is in her name, isn't it? Was
yeah,
it like Gottlieb or something? Calloway?
Yeah, I think she had a double barrel and she yeah, like, cut the bit that wasn't alliterative or something.
Yeah, I mean, good choice. All great choices.
All great choices. But yeah, sorry, I lost the thread. What were we talking about?
It's. I feel like we've started at the end in a way. We've started
oh, yeah,
with the like, here's our deep like Roland Barthes, death of the author, Caroline Calloway theories. But like, I'm kind of conscious there might be people out there who are like, who the fuck is Caroline Calloway?
Yeah, we're yeah, like, she's developed such an incredible public persona. And everyone's
yeah,
like, I've never heard of her.
There's with Caroline Calloway, you either know absolutely nothing or everything. There is
yeah,
no in-between sort of knowing. Like the way I've ambiently, for example, collected information about the Kardashians without one wanting to.
Yes.
You can't really do that with Caroline Calloway. You're either all in or you're all out.
Yeah.
So shall we do it first of all, a log line of who Caroline Calloway is, and then we will delve into the chronology of how it got that way. So in the simplest yep, possible terms, who is Caroline Calloway?
Caroline Calloway is a former influencer, now memoirist,
mm-hmm,
I would say.
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
That's it. That's the end.
That's
of the
it.
Sentence.
That's it. Yeah. That if we were to take like the absolute job title down, it, yeah, which is like that is it. That is a million chicks.
Totally. That's all of us.
Yeah. That's all of us, in a sense. Yeah. So how she became one of the most famous memoirists of our generation, I would say, and this kind of like person who's constantly being covered in, you know, New York Times and Vanity Fair, to the point where her ex-friends can write long essays about her and they can be the trending thing on the cut for like a month. We will get into now.
Great.
We're gonna start at the very beginning in 2012 where Caroline Calloway is a student at NYU. She joins Instagram. She makes an account called AdventureGrams. Now, this is the very beginning. This is where you know, Instagram is in its infancy. It takes terrible photographs with horrible filters on them. No one really knows how powerful it is yet. I feel like 2012. I was starting work as a social media manager at this time.
Oh wow!
I was 22, and my social media management mostly consisted of me managing like the Dettol and Lemsip Facebook page, and like posting a picture of like a cat with a Lemsip box and being like if you like cats, and then that was kind of it, and it was like that's how you got 500,000 followers, and that was me doing a good job.
Okay.
And it was like we didn't know, we were like just been gifted fire with social media, and particularly social media on our phones. But Caroline is younger than me, I think. She's about 3 years younger than me, so she's got to be in her late teens. She's at NYU, and she immediately sees the promise of Instagram and she buys followers, which like people do a lot now and really familiar with that as a tool, but wasn't a thing then.
Yeah, it's interesting. Part of her lore kind of, which you'll get to, is mm-hmm, that she bought followers like when, yeah, like I feel like when it all came crumbling down for her, mm-hmm. which we will get to, that was part of the reason she was criticized. Like people were like, oh, well, her following's fake. She bought followers.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like it's just a shrewd business decision and it's not like, I don't think people would bat an eyelid at that.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, she's like 40,000 as a sort of startup. Again, this is her funding her startup.
She's funding her startup, yeah. Yeah,
and it, you know, it cost her $10 or whatever. And I also, when I was working in this, you know, social media marketing, I remember doing this also, where I would make fake blogs written by fake people in order to promote brands.
You scammer.
I'm a scammer. I did it for...
You're a liar.
I'm a liar. And I did it for £16,000 a year.
Oh.
In this fucking city in a recession.
And how much did Caroline Calloway do it for?
I know. Well, I mean, I still have no consensus of like how much money she even has.
The figures that are thrown around are all enormous. They're not right? in the order of, yeah, they've got more zeros on them on the end than that.
Yeah, but I would like buy Tumblr followers for fake blogs that I would write for brands. And then the idea was those blogs would then link to the homepage and that would make the homepage go further up the Google rankings.
Okay.
And like, it was a terrible job.
I'm sorry, condolences.
But this gram is all about like, you don't have to be, you know, a rich girl or whatever to have the most incredible life. You can do whatever. And it's like this kind of genre of internet person. Like, it makes me think of, you know, that viral photo series from a few years ago where it's like a girl and her she's walking into like a beautiful beach or a beautiful landscape and her hand is behind you.
Yes.
Her, and she's like, the photo is that she's reaching you out, but she's leading you. And like that is like what this was in a nutshell.
I think the best way to describe it probably is basic. Like
basic, basic luxury.
It was basic luxury, and it was like all kind of content that we would now cringe at.
Yeah,
it was like pictures of, it was like flat lays of food, mm-hmm. and like I think her biggest one was like a picture, like
an aerial
shot of macarons. Yeah, and it was all like very sincere, like life's an adventure if only you open your eyes, kind of. Like, yeah, it was like the vibe of it was very the same kind of people who would have live, laugh, love.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. It's definitely a live, laugh, love girly vibe.
Yeah.
The following year, Caroline is accepted to Cambridge University. She moved to England. She starts posting long Instagram captions about her life there. This is where it starts to go off.
Although I think this is a continuation of the same basic brand.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, actually, it goes off so much later on. It's a continuation of the same basic brand. You're right.
Yeah. And I think in that Vanity Fair piece that clearly is burnt into our brains forever, mm-hmm. The journalist described it as like Emily in Paris, but Emily in Paris hadn't been invented yet. So it's like American girl mm-hmm. in European quaint environs, and everyone is so charmed by her.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, gosh, I went to this castle and I'm at this ball, and yeah, it's all the ivy strewn campus. It's like, I don't think we really have ivy strewn campuses over here.
Yeah, and it's like all these British men are like, wow, this kooky American girl who's so forthright with her feelings is so charming. Like, yeah, it's sort of what I mean. I guess it's what Carrie Bradshaw thought would happen in Paris,
right? 100% it's what Carrie Bradshaw thought would happen in Paris. Something we skipped over possibly in the NYU year, because what happens is she has a freshman year at NYU and then she redoes her freshman year at Cambridge, because according to Natalie, she couldn't go through her life with an NYU email address.
Yeah, I don't really know what that means. It must be an American thing.
No, I think it's a her thing. I think NYU is obviously a very prestigious university wherever you are. But I think what's really clear about Caroline from as like a basic character sketch is that she is an old-fashioned aesthete.
So, do people use their college email addresses in later life?
They do. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I still use Hotmail, so clearly I'm not self-curating rigorously enough.
I do know people who like went to fancy universities, and it's almost like drilled into you at some of them, being like, for all the money you pay to be here, the most valuable thing you will have is your email address.
Right.
So like, keep it for the rest of your life.
Oh, okay. So that, I guess it's a networking thing.
It's a networking thing. Okay. Yeah. Totally. For if you care about that kind of thing. But like, it's the... To not, you know, not even do your senior year or whatever, or like do a master's in Cambridge or whatever, but to like repeat your freshman year.
Totally. Also, NYU sounds fine.
I'm sure it's great, you know?
Yeah. am I easily impressed? That sounds prestigious to me.
Totally. But like, it's like the idea of this like very British, European sort of Peter Pan collar, you know, moleskin sort of life that's so appealing. But when she was at NYU, she meets Natalie Beach in a creative nonfiction writing class. And very romantically, their names are sort of next to each other on the roster, Calloway and Beach. So it meant that, I mean, this is the lore. Whether this is the lore it's been fueled by, I can't even remember which one of them said this, that they would share their work at the beginning of the class, and because they're both near the top of the alphabet, Beach goes first, Calloway goes second. And so their writing started being kind of a response to one another. And they become very close. They respect each other's gifts very much. Calloway is described as being somebody who like has never heard of Laurie Moore but can like recite Chaucer, you know, and like has incredible boobs and doesn't need a bra, like all this stuff, long blonde hair, whereas Natalie in her own sort of estimation in the essay that comes many years later is like, oh, I'm a short little nerd.
I think she said I went back and read that essay in preparation for this podcast.
Me too, read it on the train over.
Yep. I think she just summarized it in like the first line. She says, Caroline was everything I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Which I think is such a common sentiment that young women feel. I mean, I think that's why their friendship has resonated with so many people. Because I think most women would have another woman in their life who they think is the embodiment of all the things they'll never be.
Exactly. And I think even though Natalie Beach is like a sharp writer, what she kind of fails to understand in that very long essay that took her apparently 6 months to write.
Yeah, should we do the essay now? No,
we'll get to the essay. That she does understand that when you meet somebody who's nothing, everything that you're not, it goes both ways. It means you are everything that they are not.
Yes.
So like you can tell that Natalie has this kind of like almost Winona Ryder kind of like short, dark hair, sort of intellectualism, this sort of slightness. She's apparently kind of an athlete. She's very strong and very leadership oriented, according to Calloway. And it's like, yeah, that dynamic works both ways.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I have so much to say about that dynamic. Should we do it now?
Go for it.
Yeah. I just think it's such a... I almost think it's a rite of passage in girlhood, and I sort of do think it's something you hopefully grow out of, this like using other women as tools to measure yourself against. Mm. And it's my first book was about it was a novel about this exact same dynamic. Mm. And I think that at the end of the day, it just means that you're not seeing the other person as a real person with their own hang-ups and problems, because they're this walking projection of all your insecurities. Mm. And I think it's so common, but I think it's also very common to then, like, because this person represents all your insecurities, to hate them. And what you're really doing is you're self-loathing. And so it's not actually about them at all.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting because, yeah, as I say, my first book tracked a very similar dynamic. It was like two very smart girls. One is conventionally beautiful and the other one is kind of in her thrall and sort of blames her for everything that goes wrong. And at like book signings and stuff, so many women say to me, oh, I had a friend like that. Mm. But nobody ever thinks that they're the Caroline figure.
Yes.
Everybody identifies with Natalie.
Yes.
And I just think that's so, I just think it says something about the way women are positioned to understand themselves always in competition. Do you know what I mean?
100%. You're absolutely correct. And it's...
Thank you.
But also it makes me think about, as women, particularly as young women, like I remember like traveling in a group of friends as a 20-year-old, for example, going to Spain on our holidays or whatever, and being so, even though I loved these girls and I would call them my sisters and we'd all sort of fall asleep spooning each other in a row of five or whatever.
Yeah, sounds quite sapphic.
Yeah, it's actually a lesbian gothic.
That's a Caroline reference.
The real heads know. Still going out to the club that night after these days of like intense sort of like Rat King sisterness, and having such a clear idea of our ranking attractiveness wise, where I fell within it, and like if we were, you know, four or five girls and there was three guys, and feeling like, well, how is this going to get divvied up, and people sort of like bowing out or withdrawing because they knew they didn't really feature in the sort of top lineup, and like even if these things aren't true, even if like a group of guys are just seeing a group of attractive girls and they want to party with them. The psychological reordering that happens in that moment is so intense for young women.
It's so true. And you're so right. Men are so much more oblivious. I was like, straight men, I do think, as a generalization, are probably more oblivious. Like, I think the social accounting that women go through is so micro. Like, I remember when I was a very young woman being like, oh, well, so-and-so's beautiful, but she wears more makeup than someone else who's, like, also beautiful. And it's like, no man ever would look at those two women and, like, kind of do that really granular accounting. Yeah. But, yeah, I think it's – I just think it's a really common experience of, like, growing up as a woman. And I do think, like, I'm obviously not of the school that's, like, oh, anytime a woman criticizes another woman, that's like anti-feminism.
There's
like
a special place in hell.
Yeah, like, no. Well, like, I'm right there.
I'm in hell.
Yeah, I'm in hell. And that's where I want to be. So I don't want to be like, oh, like, anytime you criticize someone, it's just a projection of your own insecurities. I like absolutely don't think that's the case. But I do think in these examples, it is so to do with like women trying to understand themselves and understand their power in the world. Mm. And I think that in, especially when you're younger and maybe it's more sort of you're finding your sexuality. And so maybe your attractiveness is like more central to your exploration of your own power. Because
I
do think that there's this sense that the world, like heterosexual social worlds are rigged and they are, and beautiful people will always win. And I think it's easier for women to like resent the ones who are winning rather than resenting the system at large.
You're very good.
Oh, thank you.
Very good. I'm very glad you're here and I hope you come on again because I can already tell.
Oh my God.
This is a real walloper.
I'm gonna cry.
But it's so interesting because I think about this a lot of the 20s, the early 20s as primarily being an identification of unfairnesses.
Mm.
And I think that manifests in different people in different ways because essentially you're out on your own, you got your job, you got your first job in an office probably, you're bumping up against people who are older, more powerful, some of them fair, some of them unfair. You're interacting with the world in a new way. And I think also because you're such a baby, all of these unfairnesses feel very pointed at you.
Yes.
And I think for some people, I mean, there's always kind of this cliche of like, oh, you know, Gen Zs or Gen Alpha or whatever, they're so into Marxism kind of thing and they're all about
like
justice.
Critical theory, yeah.
But it's like, that's 22-year-olds, you know, like because you're so unused to things being unfair.
Totally.
Because things up till now, I mean, obviously everyone has degrees of unfairness in their life growing up, but it's like you study for the test, you get a good grade on the test, you're given praise for doing well on the test, you are then put into the higher class, you then have better chances kind of thing. It's all quite linear and fair. And then you experience the unfairness of the wider world. And I think attractiveness is probably one of the first ways women experience unfairness and therefore demonize it.
It's so true. And I think I also think that the role of attractiveness is probably inflated when you're young and basically the kind of new life experiences that you're having are really around like sexual freedom and like coming into your sexuality. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I think that when you get to the workplace maybe and you have like a real job or even when you're like applying for real jobs, that's when you start thinking more about class and like, because at that point, the things that you want to do are like have this job or impress these people. But when you're like 18, the thing you want to do is take that person home at a club.
Yes.
And so like the type of the ways in which your opportunities are limited kind of do coalesce around attractiveness in a way that they probably don't for the rest of your life. Like attractiveness obviously is always important, but I think it seems like it's of outsized importance when you're all of an age where like you're coming into your sexual selves.
You couldn't pay me to go back there.
Oh,
can you imagine?
Yeah, it's
because
so
then you hit like 23 and like you learned who you are and you like find your kind of basically your demographic of people who you want to have sex with and want to have sex with you and you learn what the quotas are around them and you're like, I'm killing it with these people.
Totally.
You know,
and it just like matters so much less. Like I think I remember when I was younger being so fixated on women who I thought were really beautiful. Like, I was just so fascinated. I was like, God, what would your life be like? And I'm just like, that's awesome for you. And like, it's a pleasure to look at your face. Like, that's great. I'm so thrilled that you're beautiful.
Totally.
But it used to, I think, and it's so interesting reading Natalie's cut piece where she talks about men treat Caroline differently. And it really is like a treatise on pretty privilege. And it's like, it's interesting reading it, having gotten over that obsession.
Totally.
Because you're just like, because I remember what that felt like. And I'm like, yeah, it does seem like the whole world is just like plain girls versus the pretty ones.
But we should move on, but it's like such an insane way to view the world and to sort of view the central activities of your life, because there will always be someone plainer than you. There will always be someone prettier than you. There's people who are far prettier than Caroline Calloway. You know, it's very interesting.
And I think that's what I mean. Like when you, as you like grow up in life, I sound so patronizing. Like I do relate to that view so much. So I don't want to seem like I'm above it. But yeah, I just think as life gets more complicated and dramatic, other things come into the mix. And so it's like, it's just not the cornerstone of your self-worth anymore. Like it's always a factor. But yeah, I the last thing I'll say on it is that I obviously like thought about this dynamic a lot when I was writing my first book, and I read, like, one of my favorite Australian authors is Helen Garner, and she wrote this non-fiction book about a very similar dynamic, which was like hot girl playing best friend, hot girl murders her boyfriend in cold blood, and plain girl's the accessory. And this was a non-fiction book about a real murder that
happened. My God, wow.
It's awesome. It's called Jo Cinque's Consolation. It is chilling stuff.
Sounds great.
It's so good. And it's and so the murder happened in the 90s. She wrote this in the 2000s, and it's just the exact same dynamic. Like the way she writes about it is about, like, I think, wait, I wrote it down somewhere. Yeah, she says, can I just read it? Because it's like exactly what, I just loved it as well, that it came up in such a sinister context and like so different. She says, one girl is wild, bossy, selfish, flaring with hormones, crackling with sexual thrill and careless of risk, but still dependent on the ballast provided by her companion, who is prim and cautious, not yet at the mercy of her body, one foot still planted in the self-containment of girlhood. They need each other. And yet it is a relationship that benefits both partners. It would be hard to say at its height whose power is greater.
Oh, that's really something.
Isn't that just Caroline and Natalie? Like, it's the same dynamic.
And it's all the dynamics.
It's all of them. Yeah. All women.
Which is why we're, you know, this happened, it's all women. We speak for all of them. But it's why we're, like, sitting in a podcast studio talking about it now, even though this, like, thing, the central drama, starred in 2012 and was written about in 2018, and it's now 2023.
Completely.
You know?
And yeah, and I think it's like that dynamic is just going to be acted out over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes with these two people, you know?
These two people. And yeah, and like you might, and in some relationships you'll be the Natalie, and in some relationships you'll be the Caroline.
And you should both know who you are and also move on from it. Let's move on with the timeline.
We should move on, yeah.
Okay, so between 2014 and 2016, big movement for Caroline. She reaches 200,000 followers on Instagram. They're real followers. Go get your bag, girl. And she's, you know, really cresting the wave of what is the first sort of big influencer movement, I think. And, you know, the kind of thing of like someone who goes on a trip to Italy and has to spend several days of that trip taking pictures of themselves in different outfits, making it look like they had a beautiful time. For them, if you're Caroline, that probably does fold into the wider experience of it being a good time. And because it's a bit like, you know, doing emails on the morning of your work trip, right? But for influencers, it's a different thing. And regular people and the world at large find that, I think we've all internalized it as normal now, but it was incredibly fucked up back then. It felt fucked up, you know?
Yeah, I think it felt like not a real job. Like, yeah.
I mean, it still barely feels like a real job, but, you know, like,
yeah. Yeah, I think people felt like it was somehow fake, or like you were manipulating people, or you were, I mean, scamming. It was kind of like, well, if you went on a holiday and you staged that photo, then...
Yeah.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like, I think people were quite sort of suspicious of it, and like what it would do to, it seemed like corrupting. Yeah.
corrupting. That's such a good word for it. There was definitely that era of like the proliferation of very young people as influencers, just being beautiful and having a nice time, and also it's like this kind of frustrating kind of solve for X in the culture of like, how the fuck are they making money? We were like, yeah. It really melted people's brains, you know?
Yeah.
And especially if you're like somebody who's the same age and who's like working a shitty office job for no money or whatever.
Yeah, writing your, like getting people to like Lemsip.
Getting people to like Lemsip. Like, it's like, I think people took to it one way or another. Either they found it sort of soothing and pretty, or they hated it and avoided all that kind of content, like me.
Yeah.
What side of that divide did you fall on?
I think I was always suspicious of it and hated it. Like, I think I got Instagram in 2013, and I definitely used to look down on influencers. And I think now I just see it as like savvy business-minded, identifying a market.
Yeah.
But I think I was very judgmental of influencers. I was like, they're fake and no one notices and like the world's a construct. And like, I think I really got my knickers in a knot about it.
Oh my, the word that you landed on a minute ago, corrupting, was exactly the complete, like if there's a word cloud of like how people felt about influencers between this time period, it's like that is this big central word. It's like, it feels like a perversion of our values as humans.
Yes, completely. Perversion. Yeah, that's so true. It was perverse.
yeah. And like, it's sort of like a symbol of sort of late stage capitalism excess that people could make money off just having a good time.
Totally. But which is so weird now because it's obviously like, well, it's marketing and all marketing. Like, I would never look at an ad and be like, you're lying.
You
know, like that Lemsip, sir. It didn't fix your cold, but like,
And
yeah.
It won't. I've read the T's and C's. It won't.
But yeah, if like an Instagram, if someone did it on Instagram, I would be like, you're lying to me. So I think, but yeah, I mean, I think that now it's reached a scale where everyone like realizes that. So it's fine. I think maybe there was a time where it was a little bit more underhand because we didn't have kind of, we didn't
have standards and the compliances I think they have to have now in order to stay on the app. So it's all a bit more clear. And also I think the media literacy of the people looking at the content has improved as well.
Yes, exactly. Like I think we just look at it now and we're like, okay, well, that's their job and they're running a business. Whereas I think at the time it was like they're just a real person who happens to like holidaying in Italy. And so it seemed more underhand.
Exactly. And while all these holidays in Italy were happening, Natalie was in the background. Again, very much highlighting the sort of friendship dynamic that we just spoke about. She was the person taking the photos. She was the person writing in her diary. And I think this is, whether this is a true diary extract or not, I don't know. But she said, I wish something bad would happen just so everything could look the way I feel, you know?
Oh, wow.
Which is, I get it, you know?
Yeah.
I get it.
It is very... It's just so, like, I sound so patronized. I sound like an ancient sage. Like,
no, I know. We're like in our early 30s.
I'm not even in my 30s, Caroline.
Oh,
I'm still.
Up.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry.
But I must look 30, so that's fine.
I just assumed us to be peers.
Okay.
Because of our minds.
Okay. Thank you. I'll take it. Sorry, I'm still a child and I'm still so petty. But that is very adolescent to, like the kind of solipsism that is required to be like, well, if I'm having a bad mood, it better be raining. Like, you know, the world must...
We better get mugged.
Yeah, exactly.
This is all kind of getting... Caroline is sort of doing her sort of savvy social media marketing. Honestly, if she had come into my social marketing agency and done a talk, she could have walked away with a couple of grand easy just for a 60-minute talk because she was savvy as hell. She started like buying ad space on like fan fiction blogs and just doing everything she could to drive things to her Instagram account, getting featured in like tech news stories and influencer news stories, courting the journalists who wrote about this kind of stuff. And... you know, also cruising the acknowledgements pages of memoirs that she loved, finding agents, and eventually, through like sheer chutzpah, got a meeting with like this, what I assume to be a top agent in the US called Bird Level.
Bird Level? Is that a company or a person?
Do you know what? I don't know.
Bird Level.
Bird is spelled with a Y.
Take my card.
Bird Level.
I'm Bird Level. I hope it's a person.
I know, I'm looking at this written down, I'm like, Could I have pasted that correctly?
Bird level.
Bird level.
It could be a person.
Bird level. Okay.
Okay, it's a person.
He says, you know, bird level. So he, she, or they say.
What did Bird say?
So what Bird says to Caroline. What Bird says to Caroline is like, you know, you got some cojones coming in my office like this, but clearly people are talking about you.
Yeah.
Get a book proposal together and
you're gonna be a star, baby.
You're on Bird's watch now, baby.
Sorry.
Love it. She's on Bird Watch. And this opens a time period that will again be illuminated in the Natalie essay, which is Caroline basically hiring Natalie to write a proposal, a very long book proposal with her that must have been great because it secures a $500,000 book deal.
Yeah. And she gets paid at least, reports vary.
Mm.
She gets paid between $250,000 and $375,000 up front.
I don't see how that could be true.
Okay.
Personally.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, that's never been my experience of selling books. But
okay. So anyway, she got some delineation of that money and then sort of goes quiet for a long time. During this time, she is addicted to Adderall. Clearly, it seems to have some kind of a lot of mental health issues. And I think it's probably will be clearer as we get further in the story that there's a lot of mental illness in Caroline Calloway's family. It seems like she's suffered from bouts of like mania and depression. It seems, I'm not, again, we don't want to diagnose anyone. But according to herself, she realizes that the book that they want her to write, which is the book she's essentially been writing on Instagram for years, and apparently Natalie's been helping her to write on Instagram for years, is like this whimsical tale of an American girl in Cambridge. And it's very odd because she can't commit to it. She has, I think it probably comes back to her being this aesthete who can like quote Chaucer or whatever, that she has this vision of herself as the author, but also wants to have a nice life and great things. And this is a problem authors come up with all the time, right? Like, we all want to have nice lives and be paid well for our art. But in order for our art to make money and for us to be paid well, it must be commercialized and it must be more of a product than perhaps we are comfortable with.
Yeah.
I think part of this is her Adderall addiction. Part of it is being kind of a screwy 23-year-old. And part of it is not being able to handle the aesthetic identity of having a kind of a commercial shitty book.
Oh, I see. So do you think she wanted to write The Great Gatsby, but she'd sold the basic Emily in Paris?
And exactly. She wanted to write Brideshead Revisited, I think.
Yeah, okay. You know? But they'd bought Emily in Paris.
Yes.
And so she just, yeah, okay, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Well, what do you think? That's from gathering that from interviews and articles, that's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, but she is going to publish the Cambridge captions now, except I guess she's doing it in like a self-aware way. So yes. People don't think that that's necessarily her voice.
Whereas this was going to be a sort of a pulpy, fun memoir probably aimed at teenagers.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And it was going to be the public like representation of what her voice was as an author.
Yes.
Yeah. That tracks for me. Yeah. Because I think that's the thing about the captions. They, like now we look back on them and we say they're basic and she talks about them in this quite self-aware way, but there was no self-awareness at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was, her public persona was like whimsy girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So yeah, maybe she sold a persona she didn't want to commit to.
Yeah, and like when you hear her speak, I mean, there's a real thing of like she's always sort of taking the long view and like she wants to mention her friends in New York in her book because she wants it to feel like Warhol's diaries. And
yes,
she, and it's obviously, it's, we all know someone who's a bit like that, yeah. You know, but she's just very frank about it.
Right. Yeah. So she'd overcommitted to a brand that she actually didn't want to be like lumped with forever.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. That tracks for me. Also, she was like 23 and I think it's interesting that as someone who's so interested in glamour and fame, she's chosen books because it's just not a glamorous life in my experience.
Not a glamorous life.
No, it's quite dull, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, maybe it's different in America.
No, it's dull everywhere. It's always been dull.
Yeah, I mean, you're a very successful author, Caroline.
You're a very successful author, I think. We're making a hash of it. We're making a go.
We're having a crack.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, maybe she just didn't like the life. Like, maybe she didn't like just being on Microsoft Word all day.
I mean, saying this, like, I've written 6 books. I've made most of my living from being an author. I'm very lucky and privileged to be in that position. I love writing. I love being alone with my work all day, every day. And I love doing this podcast as a break from that. I have still flaked on a book deal.
Yeah.
Like, I got signed to do a book of essays about 4 years ago. I'm never going to do it.
Really? Never say never.
No, I mean, never say never. Well, no, yeah. No. So luckily, the publisher I signed it with are also my publisher who publishes all my fiction. So
they know she's producing something.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, they sort of like gave me nowhere near that amount of money. It was in the single figures, the amount of money they gave me at the time.
Like a dollar.
No,
it was single figure. It was under ten pounds.
No, it was it was a couple of grand. It was a few grand.
Yeah,
and under why single digits? What did I say? What did I mean
you
by
said
that?
Single figure. It doesn't matter.
So silly.
It was less than
so
half
dumb.
A million US dollars.
Yeah, but then I realized after, and I had written a proposal, and I think this was 2019 maybe. I'd written a proposal. I thought I had enough of life experience and quippy columns and stuff out there in the world that I could write something first person. A lot of books of essays were around at that time. And then every time I thought about writing it, I felt sick at the idea of, like, I realized I have no interest in being a memoirist. Like, I have no interest in committing that sort of version of myself or the kind of journalistic version of myself to that. I don't want to let anyone in on stuff that I just don't care about it. It doesn't thrill me, it doesn't excite me. And every time I thought about that book, I got sick.
Wow.
Now, luckily, I'm, you know, a prolific enough writer with other stuff that my publisher just let it go.
Yeah.
But Caroline was 23 and crazy.
See, I think this is what I meant. Like, I just don't find it hard to believe that she didn't write it. Like, she, as you say, it's like, you overcommit. It's like, kind of boring work a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's hard to write a whole book. And she was so young and clearly a bit, you know, unstable.
Yeah.
Like, I think that is the most believable part of the whole saga.
Yeah.
That she didn't submit this book. I'm like, yep, checks out.
And also, I find it strange where people are like, oh, in the beginning of her major scamming, when she scammed this publisher, it's like, come on.
Bird level.
Come on, bird level.
The shock. He's fine. yeah.
Oh,
anyway, yeah, so she doesn't submit the book.
Doesn't submit the book.
People freak out about this.
I don't think, I don't know, this still hasn't hit you and I don't think at this point.
No, actually, I didn't hear. I haven't. Yeah. I'm not on board yet, actually. I got on board quite late.
Yeah, I got on board during the... Well, it's actually coming up.
Okay, let's
pass. So she... Hang on. Right. So between 2017 and 2018, she's in a pickle. She is not doing super well financially. The Adderall stuff is still out of control. She's not going to write her book and she owes the publishers 100 grand.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably 100 grand was what she got from the advance.
We're so into the accounting here. It's like, she's in debt. We can just say
I
that.
Know, but just, she's in debt. Just as authors, it just feels important.
Yeah.
Around this time, she starts marketing these creativity workshops for her, you know, 200,000 followers or whatever. And again, like, people do this kind of shit all the time. And like, there's no way that, and like, people default on their books all the time. And like, this is not hitting, this is like just normal influencer behavior for the most part. And then someone on Twitter whose name has basically been lost to time. I can't remember who they are, but they are instrumental in all of this.
Oh, really? I don't know. Gosh, I'm on the edge of my seat.
So essentially, there's this girl on Twitter. Can't remember her name. Very sorry. It's a bit like, you know, whoever drove Archduke Franz Ferdinand to his assassination.
I was just thinking about that. That was my exact cultural reference as well.
You were thinking about Archduke Franz Ferdinand?
Genuinely, I was going to say, no, Jenna, the sentence that had formed in my head was who shot Franz Ferdinand?
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait, I think they know who shot him. It's some other...
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Yeah, that cultural moment was also my where my brain
God,
went.
God, we're That's scholars. but it's like, I was, maybe I just think this is more important than it is because this is when I heard of it.
Okay.
So it was on Twitter. It's like, it was something to the effect of, this girl I follow on Instagram, this influencer I follow on Instagram, who I hate follow, which is another word that's sort of fallen out of favor, I think.
People frown on that practice, but it's literally what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Hate following.
Yeah.
Love that.
I just don't know why people use, I don't know what people use social media for.
Oh, God, I can't think about hate following.
Oh, really?
The idea of someone hate following me, which I'm sure they do, is very poisonous to my heart.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you're a purer soul than I.
I am a purer soul. I really just, if someone, if I don't like what someone's putting out, I just unfollow them.
Oh, I love it when I do.
Really?
Like it. I'm like, why would you put that up? Give me another one. Give me another yum, yum, yum.
Yeah.
Sorry. This is...
No, it's fine. It's maybe you're just more honest than I am. This person I follow, who I hate follow, is doing these creativity workshops, and it's all going wrong. And it's like this long Twitter thread of like all these screen caps from Caroline. And it's like, first, it's like all the things she's promising for like $100 or whatever. She's gonna make flower crowns and all this kind of nonsense, and making terrariums and mason jars and all that kind of Pinteresty craft stuff. And it's about, it was billed as a tutorial to architect a life that feels full and genuine and rich and beautiful.
Oh.
Yeah.
Obsessed.
Obsessed.
I love that she can say architect and genuine in the same breath. That's just everything about her, right? It's like, if it's
architect
curated.
And genuine. Yeah.
It's not real. Yeah. Or like, I mean, it is though. Well, yeah. I mean, that's why she's so fascinating, because it's like, if you make it up and it feels real, then it might as well be real.
Yeah.
And you can be honest about the fact that you made it up.
God.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Architect and genuine. Good.
Yeah, exactly. You can't architect something genuine.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of the breakdown of that quote. Bonkers. She charged participants $165 a head and sold the tickets before booking venues, made promises she couldn't deliver on, orchid crowns, cooked, in inverted commas, salad, and true to form, posted the whole fiasco in real time. And so the internet was just following this unraveling.
That's right. It was like creative writing workshop Fire Island.
Yes. And yep. It was around the same time as well.
Oh, okay.
So I think what we spoke about earlier on, this perversion or this corruption that was really felt by about the influencer economy in 2013, by 2018, it's reached a fever pitch of really wanting to see these fuckers burn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's like that our suspicions were correct and you were lying all along.
Yeah, yeah. This is even before any essays are written, but it inspired a piece called The Empty Mason Jar of the Influencer Economy.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know about that. Wow, so she became a metaphor for this cultural thing that we all hated.
Yes.
Wow.
Now, so is this when you got involved?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not yet.
All right, well, this is when I'm involved.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm aware that I'm talking a lot at you very fiercely.
No, I'm genuinely on the edge of my seat. I love this.
And so this should have been like one of those stories that just passes in and out with the tide, you know, like some fucked up girl just getting in over her head.
Also, it's like not that interesting, really. I mean, she just sold an online workshop and then didn't deliver. Like, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are bigger scams all the time.
Yeah, right? Like, it's not Elizabeth Holmes. Like, it's just not.
Yeah.
And, you know, it kind of, everyone gets involved in watching this, and, it ends with her sort of like sitting cross-legged on the floor of a Regis and them all eating like supermarket salads. And it's just like the grainy pictures that were taken at this are just like, oh, this is it. This is the empty mason jar of the influencer economy.
Yep.
And so it would have probably gone away, I think, if two things didn't happen. First of all, is that Caroline rapidly changes her brand, I think, which is she goes from being this like whimsical, loving life, architect something that feels genuine person to being a real like scabby, scathing, really smart, really honest presence that's just like shooting things out, searching her name, quote retweeting people.
Chaos is the brand, bitch.
Right?
That's what she said, isn't it? I think she tweeted that at one point.
Yes.
Yeah, she was like, actually, this, I have, sorry, I'm so aware that we're like going through this timeline slowly, but
no, that's fine.
Can I have something to say about this era for her, uh-huh. this paradigm shift. I think that this speaks to a different cultural problem in the same way as we had like the empty mason jar one, mm-hmm. Which is that, and I'm definitely guilty of this, I just think that like I treat self-awareness as the ultimate and like curing and purifying virtue. Mm. And so it's like if someone is a bitch and a scammer and like sells out their friends, but then they go on Instagram and they're like, yeah, that's the brand. I'm there for it.
I know.
And I think that is a bit maybe something that I need to interrogate because like just because if you're aware that something's wrong but you have no intention of changing your behavior, then that's terrible. And like we don't want like being ahead of the, you know, being preemptive in your PR and like sort of confessing your crimes before everyone else finds out about them to like be a way of exculpating them. Like that just,
yeah,
I feel like we should demand more.
We should demand more from our politicians.
Yeah, you but know, not from
but
people.
But, okay. But from chicks selling mason jars, I feel like, I don't know, again, and this is the yummy snackability of the Caroline Calloway universe is that like, it's never really hurting anyone. I'm sorry, if you paid under $65 to go to that workshop to architect a life that feels more genuine, that's on you.
I do think, though, it is like the building block in a broader structure of like looking at people and kind of excusing bad behavior as long as people aren't being hypocrites about it.
Yeah.
Like I do think that sometimes people get away with more than they should because like I read an article saying that like how Russell Brand had, for example, had cultivated quite a sort of leery, sexualized public persona. Yeah. And maybe that was among the factors that allowed him
the smokescreen that let him operate. Yeah,
sort
because
of.
Nobody knew where the line was because his whole thing was pushing the line.
Exactly. Yeah. And like obviously like that's like a much more serious case and that's ongoing and whatever. But I do think there's something about like as long as people are open about bad behavior, then we let them get away with it. And I think maybe people can manipulate that cynically. Like maybe ahead of time they're like, oh, well, I'll just behave badly and then I'll tell everyone about it so then it'll be fine.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
No, you're right. And therefore, like, that does appear to be the two options for facing public crisis now is either you go underground and you wait for another story to take precedence, which I think is like something that you see like Boris Johnson do a lot, for example.
Although he's another good example of like, he's someone who's like, well, I never made commitments to the truth.
Yeah,
and
right.
And so then people are like, oh, well, he didn't really lie then, did he?
Yeah, it's like this mix between either going underground or just like obfuscating with this, as you say, this kind of winking self-awareness.
Yes.
Well, never taking responsibility.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Obfuscating self-awareness. But anyway, I'm such a sucker for it. I love it.
You're right. It's very addictive. I agree.
Yeah. And like, I'm more interested in and I guess like Caroline more than I like Natalie. Not that matters, but in terms of my gut personal responses to them, like I would rather like have a beer with Caroline. And it's because she's so open about being a bitch.
Right.
Which is kind of, I'm like, I just look at myself and I'm like, oh, is that a problematic way to kind of assess people?
But she also just like, she often says very fucked up things that are also very smart and true.
Yeah, totally. No, it's so true. And it is kind of refreshing in an influencer economy that is so like about people being authentic and growing and being like, I've done the work. It's so cool that she's just like performing her pettiness for my everyone. Yeah. Like I do love that.
I do love it. I love it.
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah. And I also love, we'll get to what I also love at the end because we're still working through the timeline.
Oh my God, sorry. We haven't even got to her mainstream fame.
Right. So. 2019. Okay. Two workshops go ahead in New York, but the rest are cancelled. Attendees claim the workshops are disorganized and overpriced. Caroline is called a scammer for the first time. Same year, Natalie Beach publishes an essay titled I Was Caroline Calloway on the Cut, where she accuses Caroline of being a bad friend. A bad friend? How dare she? Do the people at Bird Levin know? And claims to be the ghostwriter behind Caroline's early Instagram captions. So this is This is the thing.
I'm in now.
We're in now.
This is where
okay.
I got in.
Yeah. All right. I've been talking at you for a long time, so you tell me your experience of coming in.
Oh, that's all. I just read it on the cut and I was so fascinated by it. And in hindsight, I think, and I actually wrote my first book a year after. So I think it might have like penetrated even deeper than I realized. Mm-hmm. I definitely wasn't conscious of it, but since like researching it for this podcast and stuff and going back and reading that original essay, I'm like, oh, wow, this, I think it really had an effect on me and like changed my thinking about those kind of female dynamics that we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was me. That was when I was in. And then I started following Caroline on Instagram. But interestingly, didn't even attempt to follow Natalie Beach.
Right.
Which is what I love. Natalie traps herself in this dynamic.
Yeah.
Where she is like doing Caroline's work for her all the time. Like, as in like this article,
yes,
which was ostensibly a takedown, brought her mainstream fame.
Yeah.
And she still casts her as the most interesting character. And like, if that was, I think the way that she's written about it subsequently is that she felt like Caroline had exploited her for so long and it was like time for her to get something out of it. So I think it was intended to be quite a ruthless self-promotional mm-hmm. exercise. Like, mm-hmm. I think she's quite frank about that. This is Natalie. But really, it just promoted Caroline.
Right. And it's also, and we spoke a second ago about the rise and fall of the influencer economy as per the minds of ordinary people. Mm. Do you know what I mean? About mm-hmm. like, oh Jesus, this is so you know, perverse, this is the word you got to, and corrupting and strange and fake and beautiful but hollow.
Mm.
I think this Natalie Beach timeline we're entering now has a similar but opposing kind of vibe in that, like,
it's two heads of the same coin, perhaps.
In a sense, okay, the sort of like style of millennial confessional writing,
yes,
that really makes a meal out of things that aren't that bad.
Yes.
You know, they're just not that bad.
Yes,
like,
so true.
Like, the crux of these things is like, you know, I was on holidays with her and sometimes I had to take photos of her.
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, like, to think that that was published in The Cut, and I think it was one of their most well-read pieces of the year.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, I am like, I'm absolutely the audience. Like, I lapped it up. Yeah, what is that? It's like that bad art friend that happened a few years ago as well. It's like people just having these very like intricate interpersonal feuds. And people just love it.
Yeah, of course. That's our brains. Like, we can't blame our brains for being that way. We've only evolved to like really understand the size of villages. And so when someone's having a spat in the village, we want to hear all about it.
So true.
Like,
Because I definitely, like, I definitely wasn't interested in it because Caroline was famous and I already knew who she was. I was just interested because I was like, two girls having a fight.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, and also it's like people have had enough dynamics like that where it felt interesting. And also this is the boom of, it's a different kind of boom of the sort of brunette misery economy.
Yeah. So what was that about? The like, what do you think that was about? That confessional first person essay boom? Like, it's very female coded, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was always women writing a first person essay about something bad that had happened to them.
Yes. Yeah, generally involving sex with an older man.
Yeah, it was very sexual.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to say it's like nothing that bad happened, because some of them obviously,
no, of course,
some of the paradigm ones of the genre are pretty bad, but yeah.
But it's very like, exactly, I don't want to be like, you know, just throw people's drum on the slag heap and be like, grow up. Like, but it is very like long sort of passages about, and you get this in like a lot of like novels of that period as well, and maybe still, of like, and I got home to my flat share and I ate pasta sitting on my single bed.
I mean, I wrote one of those novels.
Me too.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Good for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so that's something that also interests me about this whole Natalie Caroline thing. What I don't understand about either of them is why they don't make it up. Why don't they write fiction?
Why don't they write fiction?
I just don't get it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Tell me why, Caroline. Explain it to me.
Because novelists aren't famous. Not in the same way.
Yeah, okay.
If you want to be a novelist and be famous, you either have to be Sally Rooney or you have to be doing it for 20 years.
That is so, wow. Okay. God, like, she's wise.
That's it. And if you, like, if you want to be famous, that's the only way, you know?
Yeah. And there was this culture for a while of women like flogging their own traumas for money.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very much there in that economy as well.
Yeah. Wow.
Were
okay.
you?
No. So I was in 2019. I was in my last year of uni. So okay. I wasn't, I wasn't.
How old are you?
I'm 16. No, I'm 27.
Also.
I suppose though, because I was the target market, because I was like a literary minded young woman trying to understand herself. And I read a lot of those essays and bought a lot of those essays. Mm. And like, I read Cat Person, that short story in The New Yorker. And like,
so Cat
it
Person
broke my brain.
Like, is absolutely the example. And I really like Christine Rapeny, and I think she's really talented. But that is so, that's what I'm getting at here.
Yes.
Cat Person as an artistic kind of genre of like very deep female perspective that felt very like new. It felt like Dylan going electric at the time, but now it feels very dated.
Yeah,
you know?
it dated so quickly.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I wonder, maybe it was a post Me Too thing, like because confessional, like because obviously Me Too was a string of confessions, and I mean confessions implies that they've done something wrong. It was like testimony. Like I think it was a culture that was interested in testimony.
Yes.
And so like I think maybe there was this almost comforting. Actually, I do have a theory about this. Do you want to hear my crazy theory?
Yeah.
I've been thinking about this for a while, and I think I was thinking about it more in the context of memoirs than essays, but I think it probably still applies. I think that like post Me Too, post 2016, we were living so aggressively in such a post-truth world. It was like, we can't trust institutions. We've like all, we know our critical theory, we know our Foucault, we realize that like traditional knowledge production is just social construct and we don't really know anything. And then I think that it was like comforting to have testimony because it was like in this world where you don't know anything for sure, the only inalienable truth is your own experience. And like you have the truth of your account of what you have suffered. And so I think people found it very like kind of comforting to read all these like confessional style testimonies.
Yeah.
Because it was like this extreme subjectivity was the balm to the fact that we had the kind of lost objectivity. Do you know what I mean?
Oh my God, Diana. That's incredible.
Oh, thanks, Ingo.
Do you realize I have a philosophy podcast? I'm really, it's really blow my hat off.
Thank you so much.
No, I think you're right. I think you are right.
Thank you.
The post-truth kind of thing. And what I didn't expect to get into while covering this subject, I really thought we would just be sort of like splashing around in this like fun paddling pool. And we are. But
with Bird.
With Bird. And is that I could track my personal history, my employment history through this story. And I guess it's because I've you know, without thinking, I've lined it out here just in years. And I think about what I was doing in 2019. I was, so 2016 and 2018, I was working for this women's website called The Pool. Did you have that? Did you get that in Australia?
No, it did not reach me, but
it's sort of the Mamma Mia.
Okay. We have Mamma Mia.
Yeah.
Big for us.
This is me thinking I'm amazing because I know that reference.
Yeah. Carolina's her market.
Yeah, I know,
Australians
are
obsessed with her.
Yeah. Oh no. I worked there and it was
the pool
and it was so it sort of when we launched it would build itself as being like the internet is such a crazy horrible place now and where's all the good stuff and like where's the fun informative interesting stuff where it's like oh here's like a great lipstick hack and here's a great skirt that that Zara has this week and also here's a really interesting story and here's a funny bit kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it was interesting as the economy of the website and also the economy of websites generally shifted in even that 2 year thing where it became really clear that there was no money to be made in websites and we had to keep proving to investors that we were worth investing in. And in order to do that, you have to grow. And in order to grow, you can't do that just by like the new viral Uniqlo bag or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You have to have long, shocking essays that are cheap to produce and do gaga traffic, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, people Yeah. I mean, I think people are always interested in it because it's like human drama. But yeah, I think maybe there was just a broader cultural climate then that was particularly like just gagging for like a story that you just couldn't falsify. Because it was like, well, you said you suffered and you're the only person who would know.
Exactly. So there was a taste for it, but there was also an economical reason that so many outlets were providing that, because there was never any shortage of young women who want to break into writing by talking about their personal experience, and Natalie Beach is no exception.
No.
And they will bleed for you, you know?
Yeah,
and I bled for them as well. And what's great is that most of these websites go under. And so all of your stuff is just lying on the wind, you know? It's like it doesn't exist anymore, you know?
But no, but Natalie and Caroline's, they've bled for us and it's lasted.
Yeah.
But I think actually, I do think that's what I found interesting. Sorry, we'll get up to there in the timeline. That whole thing where I was like, why don't they make it up? That because like in 2019, that was the zenith of that culture. Mm. Like that made sense that they were producing those kind of essays. Everybody was. Why wouldn't you? But I feel like now, maybe it's just in my own reading life, I've seen so much of it. So I'm kind of personally at saturation, but I feel like we're kind of moving on.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, I think I was surprised that both Natalie and Caroline came out with books of essays / memoirs in the same vein. I think maybe Natalie surprised me more than Caroline, because Caroline is the brand. So like, what else is she going to do? But with Natalie, I was like, oh, why didn't you write a novel? Like, do you know, I was like, why are you trapping yourself in this dynamic? Like, why are you, like, just move on.
Move on.
Sorry, that sounds so judgmental, but.
Yeah.
Well, like I would have read a novel by her. Like, I would be so interested because, you know, they've positioned themselves as such ambitious writers. Mm-hmm. So I would have read anything that they wrote. And so it's like, why did you have to do the 2019 confessional essay again? Having said that, haven't read a book, so I don't know. Maybe it's maybe
nobody
it's different.
Has, and I haven't seen it anywhere.
Well,
no, and it came out with HarperCollins, I believe, right? So
yeah. Well, my favorite thing about Caroline at the moment is she posts Natalie's low sales figures on her Instagram. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen this. No.
Oh, I wrote one down because I just was obsessed with it. What did she say? She said, "Oh yeah, I'm not going to do her voice," but she said, "I found out today that since Natalie's book was announced, it sold less than 500 copies." Total. She sold 300 copies with pre-orders, 100 copies her second week, and last week the whole world bought just 81 copies. Anyways, this is why you shouldn't be a terrible person and sell out your friends. Caroline's jaws on the floor.
Oh my god.
That's her, that's in her, that's like, you can look that up. It's on her grid. It's like an Instagram caption. I just read that verbatim.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, this is why I love her.
I love her.
I'm like, who else is so publicly petty?
Because the thing is, it's like, chicken. Natalie brought a knife to a gunfight, man.
So true. It's like, yeah, it's like you're writing about how she's unstable. What do you think she's going to do?
What do you think she's going to do?
Yeah, like, you know she's unstable.
Yeah.
You said as much.
And then she, like, you know, Natalie writes this follow-up essay this year in order to promote this book that, as Caroline's kindly pointed out, nobody fucking bought.
Not even us. And we're obsessed.
I know. And in it, it's like, but in that essay, and in within it, I could even tell, like, oh, my own taste for this kind of writing is so moved on. Where it was like, on the day after that, you know, that essay I wrote about Caroline came out, I had to hide, and oh no, I hid my poor slim brunette frame under my bed, and oh no, the calls, and it's like just so self-pitying for a thing you fucking asked for. Like,
I think that's,
and I'm never like that. I'm never like, she was asking for it, but on that, but I was like, come on,
like,
you know?
What did you think would happen?
Yeah,
I do think as well, and maybe this is like an American thing. I don't want to like diagnose it, but I find the both of their unapologetic ruthlessness about becoming writers is very alien to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think in Australia, wanting to be an artist is a bit embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's like not something, it's like something you, it's like a dream you might hold very tight to your chest.
Right.
As a teenager. But like when you're like 22, if you're at a party and you're like, oh, I want to be a writer.
Yeah.
I do think people would laugh at you. I mean, I don't know. I never said that out loud because I imagined that people would laugh at me. Like,
also, if you want to be a writer, write a book.
Write a book. I don't know. But like, they're just both so like, well, I want to be a writer. And in order to make that happen, I need to sell out my friends. So of course I did it. And I just don't, I feel like that logic doesn't follow for me. And I'm like, maybe it's because I'm from a culture where it's not as encouraged for people to be that ambitious, maybe. Like, I'm like, maybe is it a tall poppy thing that we're kind of like shy about, like being like unbridled, having unbridled ambition? I don't know. But I just find it very, like, I think that it's the one quality that both Natalie and Caroline absolutely have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it very unusual.
Yeah.
I don't think I know anyone like that. And I'm also like, why don't you want to do something more glamorous? To our earlier point. I just find it very, like, I'm like, why do you want to be a writer so badly?
I know. I think for, in Caroline's case, I think she just wants to not just be a writer, but awaken a figure of a writer that doesn't exist anymore. Like, she, you know, that sort of, like, literary brat pack in the 80s of, like, Bret Easton Ellis and Donna Tartt and, like, the idea of writers on the cover of those magazines, you know? She wants to reawaken that.
I must say, I think that that's awesome if she does, because AI is coming for us. And, like, when we get to a point where a computer can write the same book, the only difference will be whether people care about the cultural figures.
Yeah.
And Caroline is like giving us something to care about. So that is actually awesome.
This is it. And also, and we must wrap this up because we've had a tap on the window. We're running out of time. But also, in a world, like, people, like, they want, I'm sure lots of people want to be famous and literary, not just Caroline Calloway. Lots of people are pining for that dream. They are just, they don't have sort of what it takes to create it, because we're also all terrified of getting cancelled. Every author is terrified of getting cancelled, even if it's totally baseless. Like, every author I've ever met is like, in chapter 7, I'm sort of nervous that, like, maybe the character, maybe it feels a little bit fatphobic. Can you just look at it? I don't want to get cancelled. And it's like, nobody cares. Nobody's reading that closely. And, like, also, there's, like, nobody is, like, speaking, like, nobody is, like, saying trashy things about other authors. Basically, authors aren't creating literary gossip anymore.
So everyone's so well behaved. That's very true.
So well behaved. Yeah. You know? And, like, yeah, books have become a very tame art form, I think. And I think that's a criticism for me.
And surely that's also because there's just not much money in it. Like, you know, it's not rivers of gold out here, and, like, the days of, like, long lunches.
Exactly.
Are kind of over.
All right, we need to wrap up.
Yeah.
But essentially, we
we'll take this.
We've skipped some things because we are running out of time in this studio. But we've essentially, in the modern day, we're up to scratch. Caroline has self-published her memoir, Scammer. Neither of us could get a copy of it, even though my assistant, Meg, who works on this podcast with me, she tried so hard, like Anne Hathaway in Devil Wears Prada, like getting the unpublished Harry Potter manuscript to get a PDF for us. She could not do it because it's all through Caroline. And basically, if you I've gotten DMs from Caroline in the past being like, babes, want my book or whatever, and I'm like, yes, please send it to me, and then just like nothing. Like,
well, yeah, and you have to PayPal her personally $65 to buy it, like, on the market. And it's called Scammer. And she's famous for being a scammer. And I'm like, I'm not going to PayPal you $60.
And you also don't know when you're going to get it.
No. It's like when the whim strikes, she'll pop it on in the post.
But
it's
but I think what's going to happen now is it's going to get picked up by a major publisher. She's made a fortune selling it personally.
Yeah.
The reviews are really great. Like, people are really enjoying it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I hope that it gets picked up by a major publisher. I'm gagging to read it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's going to be one of those, like, things that we see everywhere next year.
Yeah, do you reckon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, it'll be unavoidable. Like, every airport, it'll be in it.
Also, there have been rumours that Lena Dunham... Is it Lena or Lena Dunham?
Lena, yeah.
Okay, can you edit that?
She
There's been rumours
it.
That Lena Dunham optioned it, and I would absolutely love to see that film.
And the book is dedicated to Lena Dunham, so...
Like, to get her attention.
To get her attention, I guess, because I think Lena Dunham options a lot of things. That is the end of our Caroline Calloway episode. It could go on so much longer. But what is our final takeaways, take-homes on this?
It goes to startups. And?
Startups need funding.
Okay.
So Diana Reid, you are a real author who makes things up for
a living.
I made
it up.
You made it up. Tell us about your made up books.
So I have two books. One is called Love and Virtue, which is, that's my first book that explores a similar dynamic to this. And then my most recent one, which came out in the UK maybe 2 months ago, is called Seeing Other People. And that one is about two very different sisters who fall in love with the same woman.
Oh, I love that.